Hi, Sarah.
I'm super nervous. I'm so used to talking to drunks. So you guys seem all nice and respectable. So hopefully it goes okay. I'm so grateful to be here. I want to thank the Men in Steps Towards Recovery for asking me, especially Spencer, who has been a good friend for quite a few years. And I'm just, it's wonderful to be here and get to share a bit of my story. So I will say I have a sobriety date. It is May 18th, 2014. I have a sponsor. I have a handful of sponsees. Some of them actually call me, which is nice. I have quite a few service commitments. I do intergroup. I don't know what relates, so I'm just going to tell you what I do. I'm an events coordinator for intergroup. I do coffee and setup for the general service meeting, and I'm a general service rep. I'm a co-host of a speaker meeting, and so I'll be switching into the host position. And I'm working on the Unity and Service Conference, which is coming up this Labor Day week, and I'm the service panel chair. So I am very active in AA. I believe that service has kept me sober when all else has failed. So I continue to do service. I am grateful for the service I have, especially these days when things are so crazy. It's nice to stay connected, and it sort of forces me to do so because it's easy when you don't have meetings to go to sort of start to back off from your program. I will also say that my bestie, my boyfriend, and my sponsor are all here tonight. So you know that you're going to get the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And I'm so grateful that they came to support. I'm so blessed. I'm so absolutely blessed in my life today. And that was not always the case. So a little bit about me. I was born and raised in Contra Costa County. I'm totally a local kid, sort of done wrong, but I grew up in Lafayette. So go Dons. I heard that earlier. Go Dons. I hated it. I hated it ever so much, but I hated everything. I was a very uncomfortable child. I felt very uncomfortable in my own skin. I felt like I had been dropped into a family that wasn't mine, like that I didn't belong. There was something just wrong. And I remember just being 6 years old and wanting to like peel my skin off because I was just so uncomfortable in it. And that didn't change. I learned how to hide it. I learned how to mask it. I learned how to be who people thought I should be to fit in. I learned how to sort of play the part of a normal child when I felt like anything but. And when I was 12, I was in the car with my mom. And I said, I don't think I feel things like everyone else feels them. And she said, I think you're a drama queen. And she was totally right. I was a drama queen, but it was true. I just felt like people knew how to be, and I just didn't. And I was raised by my mom. My parents divorced when I was very young. My dad was an alcoholic and my mom was a drug addict. And by the time I was sort of in my early adolescence, she had quit the hard drugs and just smoked pot every day. But still, it was a household where there was not a lot of attention paid to the kids and me and my brother. And I took that very personally. I thought there was just something wrong with me, that I was unlovable, that I was broken, that my parents didn't pay attention to me because I didn't deserve it. And what the truth was they were doing the best that they could with the abilities they had. And my mom was working usually three jobs, you know, to support us. I mean, like, you know, but I just took everything so personally. I was like a raw nerve walking the earth, and I didn't know how to be. So by the time I was in high school, I had my first drink at 16, which is late. If you're in the rooms, you know, like that's like, I was like an elder statesman by that point. I had my first drink in high school, and I was angry. I was really, really angry at a young fella and my boyfriend at the time. And I was so mad. And so I drank at him. I would show him. It just did. And I was, and as soon as I started drinking, I couldn't stop. As soon as that first drink, and we were drinking wine coolers, which is like the most embarrassing first drink. It wasn't like something hardcore. It was like the worst. And all sugar. And I drank to a blackout and woke up on a bathroom floor the next morning, and I was terrified because I thought, I had worked so hard to build up this wall between you and me that I was afraid that I had let someone in, that I had told some truth that I didn't want to tell. I just wanted to keep you on this side and then keep me safe. And so it scared me off of drinking for a few years, but that numbness it gave me, it like, you know, I always think of myself as that raw nerve. It was like the sheath over that nerve that protected me from having to feel. And I wanted that I wanted. So I started using other substances to get that without the blackouts, because I wanted the control, but I didn't want to feel like that was it. And the more my life moved on, the harder things got. My mom was diagnosed with cancer when I was 20, and I became her primary caregiver. So I dropped out of college, and she didn't want me to move home, but I would go every week for her chemo and sit with her for 2 days while she was sick. And the feelings were so big. I was so angry. And so I felt so guilty that she was sick. I don't know. I felt like it was all my fault because I'm selfish and self-centered by nature. Everything comes back to me. And so it was my fault that she was sick, and it was my fault that she was suffering. And those people. And so I started drinking again. That's when I went back to the bottle, because what I was using wasn't working. And I started bartending in San Francisco, and I bartended during the day, and I would work all day, drink all day, get off work, drink all night, come to work, drink all day. And I would just, that was my life. And by the end of sort of this period, I was living in a residential hotel in the Tenderloin. My dad has been in and out of my life for sort of, you know, he would sort of come and go. He moved up to sort of near Lake Tahoe when I was like 14 or 15. And so he just sort of faded into the background of my world. He wasn't that important to me. I didn't really care. And he and my stepmom came down when I was living in this residential hotel and gave me a cell phone and said, just answer it sometimes when we call so we know you're safe. And I really could have thought, wow, these people care about me and they're worried about me. And they, you know, this, they're trying. What I got out of it was, yay, free cell phone. That was it. I was just living in my disease, and I couldn't care less about their feelings. It was not even on my priority. Like I couldn't care less. I answered the phone every now and again when they called. That was my gift to them. I was so terrible. I was young and on drugs and drunk, in my defense. You're all so nice. My mom died when I was 25, and I had moved back to Lafayette into her house to take care of her at the end of her life. And I tried to pull myself together. I really did. I thought I was 25. I was like, I went back to college. I, you know, tried to curb the drinking, curb the drugs. And I did a really bad job. I was just so unhappy and angry. And I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to feel those feelings. So I just numbed them. I just kept, that was all I knew how to do, was just, I don't want to feel, I don't want to be here. I don't want to, you know, deal with family. I don't want to deal with people. I avoided everyone. I just wanted to sit and stew in my misery and drink and do drugs. So I got married, because, you know, seemed like a good idea at the time. He was a raging alcoholic, and he made me look like I had my stuff together. And it was perfect, because, you know, when you're living with an alcoholic who keeps going to jail and you don't go to jail, like, you're really doing good. And, um, And I finally got tired of bailing him out. I kind of got tired of, you know, because he was a mess. He really was. Like, I was like a functioning. I had a job. I have the same job today. Quite honestly, it's crazy. But you know, he couldn't function, and I couldn't live with that. So we got a divorce when I was 30, and I decided that drugs were my problem. So I quit doing drugs at 30. And I just said, I'll just drink, because you can't have any troubles with just drinking. That's not true. It's a really, yeah, that's not true at all. I basically just dove into a bottle, and I lived there for the next 7 years. By the end of my drinking, what it looked like was I would get up or come to in the morning to get ready for work. I would be in terrible shape. I'd usually throw up, because I always did. And I would shower and get ready and then say, I'm going to make it to the end of the day to drink. I'll get through work and I won't have a drink. I'll just wait until 5. So I would just be waiting just all day till 5. And then if that got too hard, I would, you know, finagle someone into coming to the pizza place across the street and have a couple beers with me with lunch. And I would just drink as fast as I could, as hard as I could, because, you know, we had an hour. And so I'd make it that hour really worthwhile. And then I would, you know, just kind of get through the day. And then I would go to the bar. As soon as I got off work, I'd go straight. The bar I would go to was directly in between it was like equidistant from my work to my house. It was like perfectly centered. And it was in Lafayette. It was the Roundup, if anyone's familiar. And that was my spot. And I would go, it was a cash only bar. And if I didn't have any cash, I would get people to buy me drinks. I'm very friendly. And I would drink that first drink and think, okay. And it would be like, I'd have been holding my breath all day, and I finally could exhale. And then I wouldn't be able to stop, because as soon as I put alcohol in my body, I cannot stop drinking. I have no choice in the matter. And I would drink to a blackout, and then I would wake up at home. And then I would do it again the next day. And that it was like, they always say like Groundhog's Day. That was exactly what it was, because every day I didn't have any communication with my family. I have a brother I didn't talk to. I was so angry at him for something, some small slight when I was in my early 20s. So basically I had driven a wedge between us because of that. My parents, you know, they weren't good enough. Like, they weren't there when I needed them when I was young. And, you know, don't you know, I am struggling and suffering, and they're not even here for me now. Like, all of this, just, I'm going to say it, pardon my French, but it bullshit. It was like, I was the victim. Everyone was out to get me. Everyone was at fault. No one knew what it was like to be me. No one had it as hard as I do. I'm going to drink. And that's like literally what I thought. And it was insanity. That is the insanity of my alcoholism. And I drove drunk every day. I was a terrible person. It never even occurred to me that that was a problem, because I have to get home. I need my car in the morning to go to work. Like, why would I leave it here and take an Uber and be safe? And, you know, it just, the craze, like, I am so lucky. They say seconds and inches. That was what saved me, seconds and inches. I finally got a DUI. I went to a work party. I'm just going to keep my eye on the time. I went to a work party, and I threw the work parties, because if you throw the work parties, you can start drinking before the party starts. I'm no dummy. And I drank copious amounts of wine. I think probably, if I had to guess, I'd say 3 bottles. And, you know, over the course of an evening. And I left there at about 8:30, 9 o'clock. And I went, and I was thirsty. I wanted some water. So where do you go for a glass of water? You go to a bar. Made perfect sense to me. So I get to this bar, and I come to at another bar arguing with the bartender. I don't know why, but they were really mad at me. I must have done something bad. I was at Roundup, and I came to at Farrington's arguing. I think I was sleeping on the bar, and they didn't like it. And so they kicked me out of the bar. and saw me get in my car, and they called the cops. And the cops pulled me over. And he said, "Have you been drinking?" And I said, "Yes, sir, a lot." And so he arrested me. At one point in the arrest, I do believe I said, "Do you have to handcuff me? I'm from Lafayette." Because I am not a good person. That is like the most, like, oh God, how entitled could you be? How delusional. But so he did handcuff me for all, whatever. So they ended up bringing me to the station, and I was not well at all. And they ended up 5150ing me that night, which means they think you're gonna harm yourself or others. And so they brought me to the Martinez County Emergency Room, mental health room, whatever ward, and I woke up on a cot in a mental hospital wearing scrubs because my shirt had a little bow and they were afraid I would hurt myself with it, and it was Wednesday morning, and I had to call my job and say I'm not going to be. I got arrested. I didn't tell him about the mental hospital. I thought that might be too oversharing. And I thought, what is my life? Like, I drank because I didn't care. I just didn't care if I lived, if I died, if bad things happened to me, and bad things did happen to me. Being a drunk, blackout drunk female in the world, it's not good. Good things don't just fall to you. Like, it's dark. And waking up in a mental hospital on a Wednesday morning was really a like moment of, oh no, maybe I have a problem. When they discharged me at 4 o'clock that day, they wait till you're sober to let you out. It's 4 o'clock the next day that I finally blew a 0.0 and they let me leave. And I get in my car and my phone is dead. So I'm charging my phone and I have all these voicemail messages from one of my dearest friends that my whole life, like that I've known since I was 12. And she's desperate because I had told the cops to call her as a person to get me out of jail. You know, they give you one phone call or whatever. I had told them to call her. So they leave her a message. She was asleep saying, you know, we got your friend here at the Pleasant Hill Police Department. You know, you need to come down and get her. So she calls the police station in the morning when she wakes up and gets this message, and I'm not there, and they won't tell her what happened to me. So she proceeds to go to my apartment to try and find me. I'm not there. I'm locked in a mental hospital. She tries to climb over my balcony thing to get to my slider, so she's thinking that maybe I'm, you know, asleep or not, you know, well. She goes to my manager. They won't let her in. She goes to my work thinking maybe I went to work. They don't, you know, they didn't tell her where I was, or they didn't know where I was. They just knew that I'd been arrested for the DUI, which is the same information she had. So at 4 o'clock, I finally call her and say, oh, I'm just on my way home from the mental hospital. And she's like, I'm on my way to your house. And she gets there and she is so upset. She's like distraught. She's crying and I didn't know if you were okay. I thought you might be dead. I didn't know where you were. I didn't know what happened to you. And I thought, oh my God, I can't believe she cares. I can't believe that this has affected her. I didn't think my actions impacted anyone but me. And in this moment, I realized, oh God, I really hurt her. Like, I really did damage to this sweet girl who just loves me. That's her only sin, is she loves a person who's so broken they don't care. And I got into treatment after that. That was, to me, that was the moment. It was my friend Jennifer saved my life that day. Just by showing up and showing she cared. And it didn't keep me sober, quite honestly, but it got me started. And I got into treatment at Kaiser. I had Kaiser, so Kaiser. And it was great. I got a few days, so I started to feel better. You know, physical sobriety, you can't undervalue what that does for you. Because you just start to, like, when you're not waking up every day feeling awful, you're like, wow, life really isn't as bad as I thought. And that'll carry you for a minute, just the physical feeling of feeling good. And then Kaiser, you know, they do a little hug therapy. They tell you about your neurotransmitters. The problem for me with Kaiser was they gave me no solution. They didn't tell me how to live life on life's terms. So as soon as I got angry, I got drunk. I got mad at someone in, you know, some other broken alcoholic. And I just didn't know what to do with those feelings. I didn't know how to be mad and be sober. So I got drunk and it was bad. It was real bad. And I ended up passed out on a bench in front of a bar. My phone got stolen. Some kind person, I had gotten sick. It was not pretty. And some kind person came along and put me in a cab and sent me home. I couldn't pay for the cab. And the cab driver was really mad, but he was very kind and he let me off because he was going to call the cops. And that wasn't enough. That wasn't enough to prove that I was an alcoholic. What did it was I went to a wedding, my cousin's wedding. She's real sweet. They have a little boy now. And the wedding was in Walnut Creek and they say, bring a sober date. So I was like, okay, I'll bring a sober date. And my sober date was on meth because that's the decisions that I make. I thought, oh, he's on meth, but I mean, you know, it's fine. I'll just have a couple of cocktails. I'll have a drink. I'll drink gin. I don't like gin. That was my solution. So I got to this wedding and I drank gin because I don't like gin. And I had a bunch of them because, you know, one is good, seven is better. And then I switched to wine and I drank a bunch of wine and then I drank a bunch of champagne and I just could not get drunk. I just couldn't get drunk. Nothing was working. The solution had ceased to work. And my meth date, sorry, his name is Jason. He wanted to go home. So I drove him home, which was a great idea considering I'd just gotten a DUI. And I sat in the car outside of his house and I thought I can go back to that wedding. It's an open bar. I could drink all night and it will be, no one would know. No one would care. My family doesn't care if I drink. We're all alcoholics. No one cares. And I thought, there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong. I couldn't tell you who sat at my table. I couldn't tell you what food I ate. I couldn't tell you what the bride was wearing, what the groom was, the colors of the wedding. I couldn't tell you one thing about anything, but I could tell you what I drank, the order I drank it. I could tell you the bartender's names. I could tell you what they were wearing. I could tell you everything about the booze because that's all I cared about. That's all that mattered to me. That's all. And I knew that I was an alcoholic in that moment and that I could never put an intoxicant in my body again without it taking control of me entirely. So I went home and the next day I went to my second AA meeting ever. And while there, I met this beautiful, serene, kind woman who I was like, you know, not comfortably sober. You know, I had probably 18 hours at the time and I was twitching and uncomfortable and you can't sit still. And it just like, you want to peel your skin off. And she was so nice to me. She was so nice. She was everything I wanted to be. Cause I just wanted to feel better. I just wanted to be able to live and not feel the way I was feeling. And she was what I wanted. So I followed her around. She had a really soft voice. And I could listen to her all day. And finally I got up the nerve and I asked her to be my sponsor. She was my first sponsor. And she got me into the book right away. And I'm so glad because I needed a solution because I was so uncomfortable. I wanted to drink every day. I wanted to drink all the time. Like it was like that obsession did not lift for me for a long time. But I learned that just by doing the work, going to meetings, showing up, like fellowshipping, doing the stuff that we do, probably you too, that I can stay sober one day at a time. And I didn't believe in God. I still struggle with that. But she said, you need to find something to pray to. I don't care what it is. So I prayed to my mom and I prayed, you know, every day, real hard because I just wanted to feel better. And I asked not for anything concrete, just to be of service and to be kind. And, you know, I'd ask, please just remove my anxiety, remove my anger, because I was still so angry. And I was not living my best self in early sobriety at all, but I was trying really, really hard. When I was about 2 months sober, she asked me to do literature and coffee at a 2 o'clock Saturday meeting. And I was like, of course, yeah, I'll totally do that. And then I just never showed up. Because you say yes to stuff, you don't have to go. You say yes so that people don't ask you again. That's why you say yes. And then you do what you want. That's how I lived my life. That's the kind of person that I was. And she called me and was like, you need to show up to your commitments. You cannot say yes to things and not show up to them. And I was like, oh, really? Okay. And so I showed up every week to that commitment. And I, you know, did my best to make coffee and do literature. And eventually I got a service commitment as a secretary at a Sunday 2 o'clock meeting. It was the first meeting I went to where I met her. I became the secretary of that meeting. And that meeting kept me sober. I got that commitment. I probably had about 6 months sober. And I still wanted to drink all the time. And every week I think, I'll drink after my Sunday meeting. I got to go to that Sunday meeting because, you know, I have a commitment, but I'll drink after. That's my plan. And then I would go to the Sunday meeting and I would feel better. I'd feel, cause I'd been of service, cause I'd heard a message, cause I'd fellowshipped, I'd done all the stuff that we do, and I wouldn't want to drink anymore. And then by the midweek, I'd want to drink again. Then it'd be like, oh, just wait till the Sunday meeting. And then I did that. I had that meeting, service meeting commitment for, I think, about a year. And it kept me sober. Like, I mean, working the steps definitely helped.
That was definitely
working the steps important. And the third step was the one which I think to me was the most important in learning. That it's not my will, that it's not my will, you know, that I'm not the end all and be all. I am not in charge of the world, because I wanted people to be who I wanted them to be. I wanted them to do what I wanted them to do. And if they didn't, then I was not afraid to cut people off. I was not kind. I was not accepting. I was not loving. I was judgmental and harsh. And if I lost, it wasn't until I did that step that I realized that I had actually lost friendships because of my will, because of pushing my will on someone else. I had a girlfriend that I loved dearly, and I was so pushy with my opinions on her. And I kept telling her like it was truth, like it was like I was God and I knew what was going to happen. And finally she got tired of it and just cut me off. And I was like, and I thought she was just, you know, I was like, well, it's her loss. I'm great. I'm not great. I wasn't great. And I, you know, I had to learn that like people have to be themselves. People have to do their lives. I learned to keep a lot more to myself, my opinion to myself. The traditions helped with that a lot too. But when I did my fourth and fifth, my parents were obviously on that list. And I realized that like, I was not a victim. I always had a roof over my head. I always was clothed. I always was fed. I always was loved. I knew I was loved, but they didn't do it in the way I wanted them to. And that was my problem. When I finished the fifth step with my sponsor, she said, wow, you really play the victim. And I was so mad. I was so mad because I thought, no, my life is just harder than everyone else's. No one knows how hard it is to be me. No one knows what it is. No, that's not true. Like the thing is I don't know how to right size myself. I don't know how to look at my life and see like, that's just life being life. And like, you need to learn how to just take it and roll with it and not take it so personally. Everything was such a personal affront to me. And it's not, it's really not. Like, I'm so lucky. And I did not see that until I did the fifth step with my sponsor. Like I was absolutely loved, absolutely, by beautiful, wonderful people who I did not deserve. And I didn't see that until I laid out my resentments and realized how petty they were, how incredibly small. The sixth and seventh of the steps, I just breeze over. The thing is, I don't know about your book, but our book is six and seven is two paragraphs, and it's just like, boom, boom, you're done. And then you move on thinking like, oh, that was easy. Six and seven are the hardest, and they're the ones I live in today, because my character defects constantly come up, constantly. Especially if I, you know, the halt, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. I get short-tempered. I get willful. I get judgmental. I get, you know, I'm a bit of a bitch. And so I can push my will at work, particularly because I think I know how everything should be done, because I've been there 14 years. So don't you know, I know more. What I've had to learn in my life of sobriety is there are many paths to the same destination. It doesn't have to be mine. It can be yours, and you can get there at your own time, and it'll work out fine. Eight and nine were my favorites. I have one sponsee at eight and nine right now, and I have two on 10. So I just finished that with them, and it's my favorite because it's a moment you get to own it and clean it up. And I just, that to me was the most magical part of my recovery, because I got to actually say to people, I was negligent in our relationship. I did not treat you with the kindness you deserved. I did not show you the same love you showed me. You called me, I never called you back. You invited me places, I said I'd be there, I wouldn't show up. You know, I got to like really, and that to me is like, great. Okay, you said all those things, that is fantastic. But the best part of the ninth step is changing, is being better, doing better. You know, so now, like after I talked to Kim today, I was like, oh God, I haven't talked to my parents. And so I called my parents because I haven't talked to them in a couple weeks. And, you know, and that is my amends to them, is that I make sure I constantly reach out to them. You know, these are the same people who gave me a phone and said, please just pick it up sometimes. And now I make sure that I'm available to them, that I reach out. My stepmom my dad and my stepmom have been married for 32 years. And my stepmom 4 years ago was diagnosed with terminal cancer. It's like long-term terminal, but you know, we hope for another 5 years. And I called her every single day for the first 2 years of her, but she probably did not appreciate it. But I called her every single day just to see how she was feeling for the first couple years of her recovery. I'm not as good anymore, I'll admit. You know, she's feeling fine. We're in a routine. I need to be better. I text them a lot. That's, you know, so that's my excuse. It's like, well, I text, but that's not the same. It's not the same. It means more when people call and you know, connect in that way and make an effort. I love 10. I know when I've done something wrong immediately because I feel icky. I just feel icky. I can feel it in my soul that I have hurt someone or said something out of line or that I'm being short-tempered. I mean, like, you know, when you live with someone and you're in a pandemic, you spend a lot of time together, and I get unpleasant, let's just say. And I catch it and I turn and I say, I'm sorry. And that, you know, I used to just, I wish I could properly express how little I cared when I was drunk, how I hurt people. I just, it didn't affect me at all. And now it's like I went through life with my eyes closed and now my eyes are open. And I can see the damage I do. I can see the harm I have caused and any harm that I do cause. And I can do better. I can be better. And that's all I want to do, is just live my life well. You know, I used to interact with people, and I used to like it when I knew I'd say something that hurt them and they'd walk away and I knew they felt worse than when they'd come to me. I liked that feeling because I was just toxic. And now I want people to feel better. I want to give some joy. I want to give some happiness to others. The 11th step is my weak side. I pray very short. Like I said, I'm not great in my beliefs, but I've gotten on the meditation kick. I'm trying to get better about that because I feel better when I do it. And so it's kind of a selfish thing. Like, I appreciate that it's, you know, supposed to be a connection to your higher power, but I just feel better when I do it. So I like to do it. I, The 12th step is where I put a lot of my emphasis today. That, you know, 6 and 7, I'm reading Drop the Rock with my sponsor. So that is definitely a focus. But 12, you know, being of service is so important. It always has been. I love fellowshipping. I love the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. They are the best people. We're all broken and, you know, flawed in our own ways, but we're the kindest and the most honest and the most accepting. I have never told a story in the rooms where someone hasn't either said, like, I can relate, or I've done the same thing, you know, because it's like, I mean, being broken, you feel very alone. And so being in the rooms, you finally feel like you have your people, like they're broken too, but we're all striving to be better every day. And it truly is a gift. And I'm so grateful that I was able to be here with you this evening. And I thank you again.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
I really appreciate your vulnerability.
Thank you.